Good morning, diners and travelers. This is Peter, because Anne's having a fit of the giggles, which you can probably hear in the background, because today we're going, I never am sure whether I should call it Far Eastern or Oriental or Asian or what I should call
Asian.
It. Asian. Okay, Asian is the official word. But go ahead and try this one. First of all, a remarkable effort to compile a training class in book form.
Oh, yeah.
On Indian cooking, attempted by, very successfully by, what's the lady's name? Monisha, something or other.
Monisha Bharadwaj.
Well done. And he's.
And I'll tell you, if you want to learn how to cook authentic Indian dishes, this is the book for you. Well, we seem to have been getting a lot of books on Indian cuisine, and Indian restaurants are becoming very even more popular. Now, why do you think this is true? Monisha Bharadwaj is who we're talking to, who wrote the Indian cooking course, and she is a renowned teacher of Indian cuisine in Great Britain and beyond. Why all of a sudden there's been a surge in popularity of Indian cuisine, Monisha?
I think in Britain there's always been a great love for Indian cooking, and my school has been going on for quite a while. As people travel more now, they travel to India and they travel to the East, as well as the coming of the internet and television, etc., means that people can see how varied Indian cooking is, and also the availability of ingredients means that more and more people can make the Indian food at home.
Now, is it like Chinese food where the popularity shifts from region to region?
Well, actually, North Indian food has always been very popular because a lot of people from North India moved outside of India many decades ago, taking with them their cuisine. So most of the food we find in restaurants around the world is North Indian cooking. Having said that, now we see South Indian cooking also becoming more popular, but essentially what people know of Indian cooking outside of India is largely North Indian.
Right. Well, this has been true of restaurants in the United States. I know that. But now, this is not just a cookbook. You actually explain the nature and essence of Indian cooking, and you do it, you say, as if you were a private one-on-one cooking instructor in the kitchen giving you tips as you cook. Is that true?
Yes.
Right. And so you, at the end of the, you should be able to cook all these things?
Well, when I started writing the book, I imagined my reader standing with me in a kitchen as we created this perfect Indian meal. And I'd like my readers to dip in and dip out of the book, to look at different regions, maybe look at different recipes, different combinations. But it's a big book, and I've tried to include things like techniques and tips. And sometimes, you know, when I start a class in my school, we start with how to prepare ginger, how to prepare garlic. So all these basic Indian tips, techniques, ingredients, I've added all of those. And then there are also some recipes that may be slightly more complex for the more seasoned cook. And I think I would like my reader to think of it as a book that they can go to for many, many years to come.
Yeah, well, you point out that the diversity in Indian cooking is a result of diversity in climate, geography, religion, foreign influences, and it's all of that, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, because, for example, if you look at the map of India, the southern part of India is closer to the equator. It's much hotter.
Oh, yeah.
And therefore, foods here need to be cooling. So people will eat a lot more chili that makes you perspire. And southern Indian cooking is therefore much hotter than north Indian cooking.
Yeah, well, you know, I found it hard to understand that Chile was a cooling element because we think of it as hot.
Absolutely. It's difficult to comprehend, but the chilies have a substance called capsaicin in their seeds and their membranes,
right,
which is why when we eat a lot of chili, we tend to perspire. And as we perspire, we cool down.
Right. You're right. So, I mean, if you think about it, you are absolutely correct. You explore the differences of each region. And you talk about ingredients, which I think that the basis of Ayurveda is very important, that whole Ayurvedic approach to healing and how it constitutes what Indians have traditionally developed the cuisine around. And these concepts are very, very cogent right now, where so many people are, and we ourselves are now much more aware of the various healing aspects of certain spices like turmeric.
Okay. Children in India are also raised with some knowledge of Ayurveda. Because, for example, in the summer, they'd be told to go and have a bowl of yogurt to cool them down. Or if they're starting a cold in the winter, grandmother or mother would probably give them a bit of ginger to help them to get over that cold. And because of this, Ayurvedic nutrition and knowledge is so much a part of Indian cooking. The kitchen is considered to be a pharmacy. And that's where healing, wellness for the family begins.
Well, I mean, I can attest to the power of some of these herbs and spices, rather. I don't know anything about asafoetida, though. I keep coming across that. It's popular in the Far East as well, right?
It is. It is. And it's a very important part of the Indian kitchen because it's so very good for your digestion.
Right. I have to look into that. You have more tastes. In the West, we have a sweet, sour, salty, bitter, and umami. But you have also, you have six of them. Sweet, sour, salty, pungent, which is an important one, I think, bitter, and astringent. That's an interesting division of flavors. I think the more that we explore different cuisines, the wider our perception of how we taste things is going to develop, to tell you the truth.
That's
good. Go ahead.
Yes, because within Indian cooking, obviously we recognize that some of these are tastes and some of these are sensations. But we need all of them to come together in balance so that the meal tastes wonderfully delicious. For example, I always say in my classes that you don't want to get rid of bits of ingredients that could be vital for taste, for nutrition, such as we don't salt aubergines or eggplants and discard the bitter juices.
Oh, right.
We don't discard the seeds of chilies because they are spicy, hot, pungent. These are all important flavor profiles that we want to add into our food.
I'm glad you said that, because that's how I approach it all, too. So, anyhow, we were talking earlier about another reason for the appeal of Indian cuisine is that there's so much interest in all over the world in vegetarian cooking now, and large sections of India are vegetarian.
Yes.
And for religious reasons or nonviolence, what's the percentage?
Yes, about a third of India is vegetarian for religious reasons. That has to do obviously with nonviolence, but also the availability of so much vegetarian food. So the number of vegetables, lentils, beans, nuts, pulses, dairy foods, this makes it easy to have a vegetarian meal in a country that is very hot. People often prefer vegetarian food to heavy meats, etc. And therefore, the cuisine has developed in such a grand scale that you can see that the vegetarian cooking of India is a whole cuisine within itself.
You know, the thing that I find kind of enigmatic is that you teach cooking this, and you write a cookbook with recipes, and yet quantities and ingredients and standardized recipes you write are not typical of Indian, are not specific, because Indians, you say, cook with their eyes and their smell and so forth.
I think all cooking should be like that. You know, to measure everything is sometimes takes the joy out of cooking. And of course, I understand that when you are working with a cuisine that maybe one is not so familiar with, you do need guidance in terms of measures, etc. But there is also a lot to be said for cooking with one's senses. If something doesn't smell appetizing, it's probably not going to be appetizing. For example, you know, even when one cooks onions, for example, in my classes, sometimes I've seen people who cook onions till they're almost burnt. Now, that would not be right in any cooking, let alone in Indian cooking. So part of, and also because obviously when you have a recipe, there are many variables, the kind of heat you're using. You may be using electric, you may be using induction, you may be using gas. So the length of the time of cooking may change. The equipment you're using may be different. You may use a heavy pan, you may use a lighter pan. So the amount of time you'd spend with each dish may vary slightly, which is where I say then you must use your senses. So if you see, if I've said in my recipe, cook the onions for 10 minutes, and you're using a high flame or a very thin pan, then obviously that's going to happen quicker. So if one sees that they're turning black, then one has to stop cooking then.
Of course, all of our grandmothers were cooked like that. Anyhow, I mean, I kept asking my grandmother for recipes, and she thought I was retarded.
Exactly. I mean, you know, there is something to be said for using one's intuition.
Yeah, now, people might be timid about the long list of ingredients and equipment necessary, but you've gone and you've kind of simplified a lot of this procedural stuff, haven't you?
Yes, I think, you know, because the way we cook today is very different to how our grandparents cook, I think. You know, we have less time, we have more equipment, we have better ingredients that cook faster. So my recipes reflect today's cook who can, you know, have access to these things. For example, my grandmother probably used a grinding stone and spent hours cooking in the kitchen, whereas I have a food processor and blenders that can do the job in 2 minutes.
Well, this is true. The thing I love about the book is the Indian food is so colorful. It's just beautiful, isn't it?
It is, and I think also, you know, it's so visually appealing that one wants to eat it. It's full of flavor, it's full of color, texture, temperature. You've got the yogurt and you've got the salads as well, which you don't see too many of in Indian restaurants, but certainly in home cooking, there's a lot of fresh dishes going on as well. So the variety on your plate is what makes your food so appetizing.
Now, something that a lot of our listeners may not have come across, but which I want to bring up and talk a little bit with you about, is especially in London, there are fine dining restaurants cooking Indian food. Variswamy, yes, which has been open for 90 years, just got their first Michelin star. The Chutney Mary Group as a whole is at, well, let's not say a different level as if it's necessarily better, but it's certainly a whole lot fancier.
Yes.
We had the opportunity to dine once with the chef at Quilon in the Taj Hotel. And not only did we have a wonderful meal, but we also had wine, red wine that came from India as well. So, so things are changing, if you like, at the high end of Indian cooking. And also with wine available locally for the first time.
Well, I think importantly, when you mentioned these restaurants, in London especially, this is a phenomenon in London, say, and in New York probably, where chefs came over from India and from specially trained chefs from the catering colleges, institutes, came over to the UK and to the USA in the 1980s. And I was a part of that movement as well. And many of the chefs who created these fine dining restaurants and who gave them their brand have all come at that time in the 80s. So, for example, in New York, you have a chef called Floyd Cardoz, who was my college mate from the Institute of Hotel Management, Mumbai. Again, in London, you've got chefs from Chutney Mary Amaya. They've all been in our colleges. So that was the big wave, and that's completely, that cuisine is completely different to the cuisine you find in your average high street Indian restaurant, which have chefs who don't have that kind of training. Often they're chefs who've learned in the kitchen from other chefs, or it's a family business. So the kind of cooking that one is looking at is completely different.
Oh, it's amazing. It's a real eye-opener to see these places.
Well, now, which is yours is the latter, then?
She's a cooking school.
But you're not trying to emulate, then, Floyd or these other characters that you mentioned?
Well, the thing is that I come from a background of being a trained chef. So I know the techniques, I know the tips, I know all of that. But then I apply those to home cooking, because that's where good health is. Where restaurant cooking is all about an occasional treat. It's never meant to be your everyday food. So I'm trying to apply my knowledge of food, and I do that through my books and my work, to everyday home cooking, because I'd like my readers to feel that they've created a meal that is healthy, that's delicious, and that was fun to make.
Manisha, you are amazing. I mean, your book is so, I mean, anything anybody would want to know about rice, you can find it here. It's, you know, flowers. Look at all this, the information you have on flowers.
It's unexpected. I mean, the Indian cuisine, the Indian cooking that you demonstrate is unexpected, and I want to give you one example of unexpected that we experienced, and then perhaps you can mention a couple of. I don't know. You don't know what I'm going to say.
Yeah, I do. You're going to talk about those potatoes.
No, I wasn't going to do that. Although I did think that the potatoes with I think it was turmeric in them.
Manisha, you have the recipe in here. What did you use in there? What herb was it in your
cilantro?
No, it wasn't.
It's an herb that turns it
either. Fenugreek.
Fenugreek.
Fenugreek. Okay.
And this was the dish Anne's talking about was actually cooked by an Indian chef from Houston, Texas. But I was going to relate to the time we went to Amaya. I think the second dish we had that chef prepared specially for us was liver. And I never associated liver with Indian cooking before. And I'm guessing maybe you can suggest a couple of other things that are real total surprises that are in your book.
Yes. Well, it's more than surprise. I think it's because, you know, often people think that what they're eating in an Indian restaurant is what people are eating at home. And that's why in my book I've said that restaurant cooking versus home cooking, they could be considered two completely different cuisines. So what you're eating at home is a huge variety of different meats and different vegetables, lentils, beans. But what you find in a restaurant, obviously, I mean, the space is limited and the menu is limited. So there's the, you know, usual favorites. Like my friends who are even Michelin star chefs, they say to me that however posh their restaurant and their menu is and however creative they are, in Britain they still have to put chicken tikka masala on the menu because it's the most popular thing.
Right. Listeners, the real deal on a really experienced and sophisticated palate. Manisha Bharadwaj, is that right, Manisha?
Yes, it's Bharadwaj.
Bharadwaj. The book is called The Indian Cooking Course, and she really distills. How long is your regular course in London?
It's a day long.
Day long.
So the day course is one day long, yeah.
So, but at any rate, I don't know how expert you'll be when you finish this cookbook, but you're certainly going to know an awful lot more than you do now about Indian cuisine. I'm impressed, Manisha, and I'm going to test it all out by doing those potatoes, because that's all Peter ever talks about. With the fenugreek potatoes. So, anyway, I thank you for talking to us, and I wish you much success with this book, because it's a really fine piece of work.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Okay, Manish, thank you. Great job.
Indeed, Manisha.
And our next guest is an even greater job by Anne and Peter, but we'll come to that in just a second. We have to take a break now. We'll be right back. And then we'll explain.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Okay, so our next guest is a famous guy. A famous guy when it comes to dealing with the cuisine of his native land of Thailand.
Yeah, we're jumping from India to Thailand.
And we're jumping from a somewhat civilized part of the world to a part of Thailand that I think is fairly far away from most communications facilities, because we were on a cell phone that was just a trifle scratchy.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
And I would consider this patting myself on the back fairly heavily.
This is
a masterpiece of sound editing, but enabling us to bring you a real authority on the cuisine of his native land of
50
Thailand.
50 great curries of Thailand, which you all should learn how to make. And the author is Vacharan Bumachitr. One very handy little book, if you're fond of Thai food but don't know where to start. We're going to be talking to Chef Vacharan
Bumachitr. You can call me Vach.
Vach Bumachitr. Is that right?
Bumachitr.
Okay. Just say it once more so our listeners know exactly who we're talking to. Can you say your name?
Spelling?
No,
just
say it.
Yes, my name is Vacharan Bumachitr.
Okay, good. And you are in Thailand right now, is that true?
Yes, in Thailand, in Chiang Mai, in the north of Thailand.
Oh, okay.
If I can just change the subject momentarily, just because it's significant. Everybody in Thailand is very sad right now, right? Because the king just died.
Yeah, it was about a week ago.
But we saw pictures, and everyone is mourning him. He ruled for the longest time, did he not?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, and now it's over 70 years. Become king. Yeah.
And he was much loved.
Yeah, nearly all of Thai people loved him. Yeah.
Now, you have written several books here, including the Big Book of Thai Curries, which is sort of the Bible of Thai curries, the Big Books of Noodles, and Stylish Thai in Minutes.
Yes, yes.
But this one
that's quite the latest one, yes.
But this one is, I think, destined to be a very useful little handbook called The 50 Great Curries of Thailand. Why don't we start
quite
simple?
It's small and very easy to carry and to read it out, yes.
Let's just simplify something here. In case people don't know, what is curry?
Well, I would say that curry is a kind of mixing with herb and spice, you know, in Asia. When we make curry paste, you know, we have to bring a lot of different spice. And, you know, kind of, Thai, normally in Thai curry, we use quite fresh herb and spice. Not the same like Indian. Indian, they use quite dry spice. So that's why a little bit different between Thai curry and Indian curry.
Well, now, there's four tastes that are always associated with Thai dishes. Is it sweet, sour?
Uh-huh.
What else? sweet, sour, bitter. What are the four tastes that define Thai flavor, flavor profile?
Mainly keep hot and spicy.
Hot and spicy.
Because, you know, we have a spice from chili, and also the red ginger, garlic, and peppercorn. That gives hot and spicy.
Yeah, now I was curious that it was not always spicy. It was spicy only after chilies were introduced from the New World into Thailand in what, the 12th century, 13th century, 16th century? No, it would be 16th century. Chilies New World.
The chilies can be quite a lot of different countries. You know, they have a lot in our country also have a curry as well. Japanese also have curry as well.
I'm talking about the spice. What was characteristic of Thai food before you got the heat from chilies?
Really difficult to say. You know, it's been with Thai food. You know, we have a lot of spice for a long, long time as well. Of course, in the history, the chili traveling, you know, from abroad. It's like everything, you know, it can be different, come from different country, and, you know, we are mixing until become our own style and make a difference from another country. Yeah.
Now, the street food is what people associate with Thai food a lot. Why is there so much street food in Thailand?
I don't know. Most the hot countries, they love to have our spice, and we believe, you know, after we eat hot spices, we get sweat, and the body is really cool after that. To, you know, less hot from the weather.
It's time consuming to make all these pastes with the mortar and pestle, isn't it?
Yes. Everything has to pass until really fine and become paste, you know, and then we stir fry and mix in the coconut milk or milk, you know, to make a sauce. Yeah.
Right, but you say not to use a food processor, use a mortar and pestle.
Yes, we use that. We have made from stone, wooden. Clay, you know, it's a term of different parts of Thailand.
Now, you mentioned different parts of Thailand. One of the things you explore in this book is there's diversity even in Thailand, like northern and southern, for example. What's the differences?
I think it's about every country, you see, the north, we can grow something. It's not growing in the south or the northeast or in the center of Thailand, you see. That's why every part of Thailand, the food will become different. That's because the ingredient we grow were in different parts of Thailand. So the people just use the local ingredient the mainly for the, you know, to make the taste of food.
Uh-huh. And I can see so many different influences in these recipes from other cultures. Like, I mean, I associate bitter melon with Chinese.
Uh-huh.
What are the influences?
Well,
go ahead.
Well, every part, I think everyone has an influence from the neighbors, you know, the north, we connect to Myanmar. The taste of food, I think, is similar with the Myanmar food.
Mm-hmm.
The southern, we mix to Malaysia, Singapore, the curry or noodle, and then we got influence from Chinese and India as well, from the south of Thailand. So, I think the same thing, like in Europe as well, is that every country we have mix the style that until everyone tried to make our own dishes to become, you know, belong to those countries and people.
Now, you said your grandmother was a princess. Didn't you write that your grandmother was a princess and grew up in the royal court?
Actually.
She's royal family.
You know, that is, for me, it's quite a long way. You know, one time I had been in the palace to visit this present king, and because of those days, he invited all the royal family in different lines, and my mother group, we called Chakapan. And the thing is, for a long time, like the King Rama the Fourth, he had so many prince and princess, and then, you know, everyone has different group of family, different lines. And that's why country quite strongly we love the royal way, you know, we have to keep the country have king, will continue. But in the moment we're waiting for the King Rama the Tenth, but the crown prince the whole family is still quite sadness, and he says he don't want to celebrate becoming the new king because in the moment we have a, you know, cut off a funeral, we have a go to temple praying every day for 1 year.
After one year
the crown prince he will say, okay, then the country accept him to become a new king, then we can have a celebration for the new king.
Wow.
Yeah.
In the moment of Thailand, you know, everyone wear black and white, not colorful as before.
Vetch, this is Peter talking to you. I was interested to turn to the page where it says, what you drink with Thai food. And it was very interesting. It's very interesting because you say coffee. You say coffee with tea.
Well, the thing is, let's say sometime at lunchtime, if I have a quite spicy salad or hot noodle, spicy noodle, myself, I love to have iced coffee to drink with. You know, I don't know, myself, maybe not drinking alcohol much. But for the evening, when the people are drinking, we're going to have mainly whiskey or beer.
Okay.
To go with the hot, spicy salad or a little snack that had to be quite spicy, that to go with alcohol. And then this is like a appetizer to starter, you see. But when we're going for the main course, we not drink alcohol with it. We drink alcohol to start with. Uh-huh. About jelling meal, we have drink just water, plain water.
Interesting. Now, you've very carefully selected. How many recipes are this one?
50.
There are 50 recipes, and you designed them and described them so that...
I've been talking with the publisher as well, you know. The publisher would like to have a bit of fatter with his man, a little bit of salad, and then a little bit of noodle, a little bit of real curry, can be dry curry and liquid curry, to serve with noodle or serve with rice as well. So that, you know, I'm trying to select the best that I like it.
I see.
And I think it's quite easy to follow up to cook. For the foreigner to understand. And thinking about the ingredient that I'm quite sure that you can find abroad from Thailand, you see. Because some ingredient, it has to be very, very special from the south or from the north. That's why we have a lot of different curries, you know, both the north and the south. And just only if you want one special curry from the north, you have to go to the north of Thailand, because the ingredients are very delicate. It's not traveling. It can be by after a few hours, you know.
Sure.
Some dishes, when we go different parts of Thailand, we have to go, let's say we go to the south, we need to have the southern curry.
Now, we were very surprised by Chef David Thompson. Do you know him? He's the Australian.
Yeah, I know him, yeah.
And he had his restaurant in London, and then he moved it to Bangkok, which seems like a very...
I used to live in England, and I do know him, and this is his restaurant. And one time, he let's say he's an Australian chef,
yes.
Been invited to Thailand, and myself been invited from England,
yes.
who have experience and have restaurant abroad from Thailand, and we have like a conference in Bangkok. Both say the government try to invite all the chefs who popular or success abroad come back to Thailand and try to talking with the people who love to do the business in abroad as well. That's how I met David Thompson. He say, you know, he been studied from the Royal Chef, one of his teacher.
Right. Well, this is a wonderful book. I looked through a lot of the recipes. They seem like things that you could make at home, and you were careful to make sure that you didn't have obscure ingredients. You have to wait to get to Thailand to do that. So it's called 50 Great Curries of Thailand by Vachering,
uh-huh.
And I'm not even going to try to pronounce the last name. And
Vachering Pumichi.
Yeah.
Pumichi.
And we wish you a very pleasant evening.
Pumichi, yeah.
We wish you a very pleasant evening, because I think you're about 11 hours ahead of us. We're just starting our day. You're just concluding yours, but it was so nice to talk to you, and we wish you continued success.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, you know, I almost feel like I'm cheating on this because it's Emily Johnson, which is, she's calling from England. Although I must say that the last time we were there in your homeland, I didn't notice that many coconut palms.
No, we were kind of joking about that.
Yeah, but anyhow, her book is called The Goodness of Coconut from that The Goodness of series, and let's listen to Emily.
And of course, if you're wondering where it fits, coconut is a key ingredient, especially in Thai curries, even more than Indian curries.
Oh, yeah, right.
But apparently, the further south you go in India, the more coconut you get in your curry there, too.
Right.
So we're on the right track here, and what you need to do is find yourself a reliable source of coconuts. I was at my local Whole Foods store today, and they did have some.
They did.
Yeah, they had some. So they are out there. I think they need to be purchased with care, as we discussed in the interview. But it's certainly they're very good for you. They're very good for you, and they're very good for your spicy dishes. And
there
we are. Well, I mean, I guess we should probably play the interview. Huh?
Exactly. From time to time, you'll note, we've been featuring books from the series called The Goodness of blah, blah, blah. And today, the goodness of is coconut, 40 irresistible energy-packed recipes. And we're going to be talking to the author, Emily Johnson. Is it Johnson or Johnson, Emily?
I think it's originally supposed to be Johnson, but I always say Johnson. It's slightly easier for people.
I bet you have to, bet you have to spell it out, though, right?
Yes, I do, all the time.
Now, tell me this. How did you get picked? I don't notice. We've been going to, of course, Peter was born and raised in the UK, and we've been going for over 43 years, but I never saw any coconut palm trees there.
It's true, there aren't any, but with the sort of health revolution over the last few years, it's a product that's become more and more popular. So I think we have lots of coconut products imported from Thailand, and then lots of British companies have started producing coconut products. So the sort of the coconut flour and the coconut sugar and things that I use in the book are produced by British companies. So it's really popular here now.
Now, how did you become such a coconut expert? I was going to say nutcase, but
coconut case. Well, I mean, I suppose I wouldn't like to think of myself as an expert, but I'm definitely a fan of coconuts. I was half raised in Southeast Asia. My father lives in Singapore, and I lived there as a small child, and kind of spent a lot of my childhood in Southeast Asia. And I've obviously it's a big part of the food over there, so I've always been a big fan of fresh coconuts and coconut products. And I suppose over the last few years, as it's gained popularity, I became more interested in it and its properties. And I was doing quite a lot of running a few years ago, and I didn't like the thought of, I was training for a half marathon. I didn't like the thought of drinking sugary drinks to keep myself going. And I read about coconut water being full of natural electrolytes, and I found it really helpful. And also it's excellent for hangovers, which is also good.
It's also very good with scotch.
Yeah.
It goes well with scotch.
Doesn't it really? I've never tried it with scotch.
Yeah, I was going to interrupt at that point and say that and discovered that it makes an excellent cocktail.
Yeah, well, I can imagine, actually. And I suppose then it cancels out any hangover, doesn't it?
I don't know about that.
So tell us how you organize this book, because it's a little bit unusual.
Well, yes, because we sort of wanted to keep it quite healthy. I didn't want a sort of huge dessert section. And also, I wanted to focus on the different products, the different coconut products that you could use. Chapters are divided into milk and water, so it's sort of drinks that you can make with the water, and lots of different recipes that you can use with coconut milk. So breakfast through to main meals through to desserts. And then I have an oil section which just sort of focuses on all the different ways that you can use coconut oil. And we're trying to, the publishers and I were trying to branch away from using coconut in a purely sort of Asian way. So it's sort of introducing recipes that you could use it with and just swap out your regular oil. And then there's coconut flour, and so that's baking recipes. There's breads, there's brownies, there's pancakes as well, which are really good.
Yeah,
and
they worked well, yes.
Yeah, they work really well, actually. And then there's desiccated, that's a sort of dried coconut. So I think one of my favorite recipes from that section is chicken breast, which is coated in desiccated coconut with some lime zest, and it's really tasty, and it's obviously much healthier than fried chicken. So it's sort of trying to find healthier ways of using these products in healthy ways.
Now, you position it as a superfood.
Yes, I mean, it has been hailed as a superfood recently, and I think I say in the sort of opening pages of the book that the word superfood has been used to describe a lot of different ingredients, but I think that coconut really is quite miraculous, and that it's seen as quite a whole food in itself. I think that there's somebody's done some research and said that actually a human could survive purely off of coconut because it's got so many vitamins and minerals, and it's got good fats, and it's got the water is so good for you and nourishing, and the flesh is also really good for you. So I think as far as superfoods go, it's a pretty super one.
Yeah, we sort of tested that all out when we were in Fiji when we used to pick coconuts off of the ground. You know,
oh, amazing. Yeah.
The clever trick Anne discovered was that you could pay the help at the resort we were staying at.
To open it.
And they'd shin up the tree and get you one or two.
Oh, that's fantastic. There's nothing better than, I mean, as I said, as it's become so popular over here, you can even get, you can get fresh coconuts now, but obviously nothing tastes quite as good as in a tropical country having a fresh coconut on the beach. It's just amazing.
Well, you seem to have developed a repertoire of good pairings, like shrimp. You have recipes with shrimp and coconut. Talk about those.
The shrimp and coconut. I'm just going to have to recall that recipe.
Well, there was
a
taco.
Oh, yes, the taco.
Shrimp tacos with coconut and
lime. Yes, I mean, that's quite a classic combination, I suppose. I mean, with like Thai prawn soups and things like that. But, yeah, I wanted to, I think because it's become so much more popular over here, and it's always been popular in the States, but I wanted to just try a different kind of dressing for it, and I found that the combination of the coconut and the lime went really nicely with it.
Now, one of the most interesting things about coconut as an oil is that, at least in some of the ways it's packaged, it's actually solid. I mean, it's soft, but it's solid.
Yeah.
Now, we've actually got both. We have two coconut oils in the cupboard, which are like an oil. And, mm-hmm. then we have another one that looks more like an ice cream tub than anything else, which is solid. Now, how come?
Well, it's got the particular structure, but it's a whole fat. Sorry, it's a bit of a difficult question to answer. I don't actually know why it's solid.
Okay.
I can't answer that off my head. I'm not completely sure as to why it's solid at room temperature, but it's obviously it melts at a low temperature.
Right, right. Now, I did find it interesting that you think it has a low smoke point when you cook with it.
A low smoke point, yes. Yeah, so it's not actually, it's not the right ingredient to use for deep frying, because also the all of the vitamins and minerals will break down if it reaches a certain temperature. So it's better really for kind of light frying and kind of more slow cooking, not so much really high smoky cooking. I think if you were going to do something like a really, really hot stir fry, I do have a stir fry in this book, but I don't do that at such a high temperature. But I think if you were going to do something at a really, really high temperature with it, it might be better to add a little bit kind of towards the end from more of a flavor perspective.
Sure. It's funny, right? Right now, there's a great nut oil producer here in the United States. The owners are actually French, but they live and work in California, called La Tourangelle. And I just got a new oil from them, which is a combination of sunflower oil and coconut oil.
Oh, really?
That will probably be better.
Yeah, they're on the can it says suitable for high temperature cooking, so I've been using it for that.
And how does it work then?
It seemed to me that it worked very well.
He's a fried genius, if you can believe that. I mean, he makes the best fried potatoes you've ever seen in your life.
I'm a fryer.
The grandkids love them.
It's like
I can't fry at all. I don't do it right.
You remember the old joke about the friars?
No.
the people who used to live in monasteries.
Yeah.
And I think somebody... And this joke goes, the punchline is, I'm from the local laundry. Do you have any dirty habits?
Oh, God. Can't let him out. See, I just hit on another one.
John Cleese could get away with that one. Dudley Moore could get away with that. So why can't I?
Here you have shrimp with Asian greens and noodles is another shrimp and coconut recipe.
Yes, that's right. Yep.
So
it has some nice ginger in it as well.
You sort of avoid the sweets, except you do have the orange and poppy seed muffins that look actually healthy.
Yes, well they are healthy, but they're very tasty. Actually, they're good for breakfast. And I use blood oranges, and they kind of create a nice look and taste really delicious as well.
Now French...
But that one, those ones are actually mostly spelt flour because coconut flour, it does take a little bit of getting used to because it absorbs, because it's not a grain, so it obviously behaves differently to other flours.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. How do you, you can't just substitute coconut flour in there.
No. So I do say that in the book. I do talk a little bit about that. You can't just substitute it, which is tricky. So it is better to kind of, unless you want to do some experimenting yourself, but you will find that it absorbs. Okay. So yes, because coconut flour isn't produced from a grain, behaves very differently to regular flour. So. I found that it absorbs a lot of liquid. So in the recipes that are in the book, I've used a lot of eggs, and also in some of the recipes I haven't just used coconut flour. I've mixed it with spelt flour, which will help the structure of the cake. But if you cannot tolerate eggs, then you can mix it with a flax egg, which is ground flax seeds mixed with a bit of water, and I think it's a tablespoon of mixed with some water, and that is substituting, and that is the substitute for one egg.
But it's
very, very absorbent.
Now, I mean, I think you're pressing a little bit when you call these date and cocoa items energy bowls.
Hey, she's the one who ran a half marathon, not you.
Yeah, that's true. I know.
Yeah.
I'm not sure this is what would do it, though.
Yeah, the energy balls, I mean, they're very popular, those sort of recipes. You know, they're all on all sorts of kind of lifestyle and health blogs. But they're a great, I suppose, it's really like, they're quite truffle-like in texture, and it's it's like a substitution for a chocolate bar or some sort of treat, and it does give you a kind of good instant hit of energy. But the coconut in that, because of the fat in it, that kind of, it slows down the release of the sugar. So it's obviously much healthier for you because it's natural ingredients, but also if you do have one of those and you're going out to exercise or something, you'll find that the energy will be released over a longer period than if you were to have some sort of chocolate or candy of some description.
Well, yes, I guess. I'll give you that one, Emily.
Yes.
Well, it's interesting to view this coconut, which is always, it's just so attractive and appealing in all regards, to view it as a superfood. I thank you for these healthy recipes as well.
Oh, well, I hope you enjoy them.
The only thing I'm worried about, Emily, is that you're going to run out of coconuts in Buckinghamshire.
Yes, we might do. I've got some reserves.
You do, okay.
I've got plenty.
They're
so I should be fine.
Coconuts are obviously widely available in the United Kingdom. I guess they're available here, not widely,
yeah.
I would
yeah,
say.
But you have to watch out because they tend to sit around and get moldy. You can see that if you look at the eyes, what called the eyes, you can see
moldy eyes. I mean, luckily the coconut water is available in cartons, and the other products are all ambient, so they keep pretty well. Uh-huh. So that's good.
Well, that's terrific. It's been so nice talking to you, and
been lovely to talk to you.
Okay, today no previews for what's coming next week because we're not sure yet. But we are sure that it'll be another exciting program all about the world of culture and food and wine and travel and all that stuff that we all and you all enjoy. So until then, we hope that you'll join us same time, same place. And in the meantime,
bye-bye.